Educational exchange and technological advancements are paving the way for a new generation of global interconnectedness, with young people leading the charge. In the context of U.S.-China relations, this seemingly presents new opportunities to promote better mutual understanding. And yet, U.S.-China mutual trust is currently at an all-time low, U.S. unfavorable sentiment toward China is at an all-time high, and the overall relationship between the two countries is as tense and strained as ever. What are the prospects for getting the U.S.-China relationship back to pre-COVID-19 and pre-Trump era levels of functionality? What can history teach us about how to approach the challenging issues in the U.S.-China relationship today? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these questions is Dr. William Kirby, professor of history and business at Harvard University. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
David, thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Bill Kirby is Spangler Family Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School and T.M. Chang Professor of China Studies at Harvard University. He is also a University Distinguished Service Professor. Dr. Kirby serves as chairman of the Harvard China Fund, the university's academic venture fund for China, and faculty chair of the Harvard Center Shanghai, Harvard's first university-wide center located outside the United States. Bill, there seems to be a consensus in the United States today that China today is fundamentally different than the China of the pre-Xi Jinping era, that China has aspirations and indeed is on a trajectory that is qualitatively different than what we observed under Hu Jintao, Jiang Zemin, and previous leaders. Would you agree with that assessment?
David, I don't think I would agree precisely with that assessment. I think China is on a trajectory, really since about the year 2000, after President Jiang's tenure, toward a more state-led economy, toward a greater role of the Communist Party, or a, shall we say, a renewed role of the Communist Party in day-to-day governance at virtually every level. But this has been taken further by President Xi Jinping than any of his predecessors. So it's a greater emphasis, and I think in Chinese political terms, it is a greater tilt to the left. I should say that probably the biggest change is our expectations of China and our perceptions of China have changed. Many Americans believed that with a growing market economy and a growing economic presence in the world, China would turn toward political reform and somehow or other be more like us. But over the last 10 and 15 years, it has become rather less like us in its own internal dynamic. And hence a considerable disillusionment on the American side, but we have to question whether our initial perception was correct in the first place.
In the United States, we often talk about, quote, the rise of China, which to the American ear tends to have a negative or even ominous connotation. What is your take on the phrase, the rise of China? Is it the right or best way for Americans to frame China's development? And do you think China's rise in development inherently occurs, as seems to be presumed by an increasing number of Americans, at the expense of the United States?
Great question. You know, the term the rise of China, 100 years ago, when the Republic of China was founded, 110 years ago, was actually a very positive phrase. There were books written about the rise of China, the ascent of China, the dragon awakes, many kind of book titles that we still see around today in 1911, 12, 13, 14, 15. During the Second World War and in the aftermath, or at least the anticipated aftermath of the Second World War, when China was our close ally, Americans were all in favor of the rise of China as a regional and global power to counterbalance Japan, the Soviet Union, and others. And so context is everything for certain political phrases. The way I think about it, and my colleague here, Peter Bull, and I are doing a new online course on this, I think of what we are seeing today as the return of China, a return of China to a rather natural position of global importance, economically and also politically. And it is not a recent rise. People think that it's only the last 10 or 15 years that suddenly there's this been enormous growth in the Chinese economy. That certainly has happened, but also in its political ambitions. But China as a nation state has been rising for over a century, gradually but steadily. And when it has ceased to rise, for example, in the Maoist period, that's because of self-inflicted wounds. This is a civilization with long roots and a modern country with comparatively new institutions that is making its mark in the world.
I think that's a really profound point, Bill, that, and another example of how when one takes a longer view of a trend like China's development, China's rise and growth, it looks different than it does when one is applying a temporal framework of just maybe 10 or 20 years. And so I think that point is really well taken. On the topic of education-related issues, I wanted to ask you, as the relationship between the United States and China has become more strained in recent years, we've seen a significant push on the part of some prominent Americans, including a number of members of Congress, to restrict educational and cultural exchanges with China on the grounds that such exchanges serve China's interests but actually undermine America's. Do you think U.S. concern about China's presumed exploitation of the U.S. educational system is fair or overblown? And where do you see U.S.-China educational exchanges going over the coming several years?
You know, no part of the U.S.-China relationship going back now over 150 years has been more important and really more enduringly successful than the relationship in education. Many of the leaders of 20th century China before the communist period were educated in the United States. Many of the business leaders before 1950 and after 1980 also educated, or their children educated, in the United States. Countries have competed for two centuries to educate the future leaders of China in Britain, in Japan, and in the United States for their own purposes. But I think we have to recognize that what is happening in China today is so beneficial to us, possibly, if we exploit it in the realm of educational exchange. China today has built the largest system of higher education in the world. But it had strong roots back to 100 years ago, the first Chinese universities founded in the 1890s, strong roots and connections also with the United States. The great Tsinghua University was founded as a prep school to send young Chinese to the United States. And now it welcomes students from all over the world. A place like my university, like Harvard, if it is to compete with the best universities in the world, it has to be able to recruit the best students, undergraduate, and particularly in research areas, graduate students, from a pool of global talent. And quite frankly, my view, China has more of the best human capital than any country in the world, a highly educated population with a strong commitment to education. This exchange benefits us enormously. And let me just say, a couple of years ago, I was in Beijing with Harvard's president, Larry Bacow. And President Bacow, who was really a visionary man, came with the view that we would explore how universities could cooperate at a time when governments were having great difficulty doing so. And we met with President Xi Jinping in the Great Hall of the People, where President Xi, for a national audience, as it was reported in the news, evening news and elsewhere, made it very clear he had a commitment to enhance, not to undo, the Chinese-American educational relationship. It is one area that is of absolute mutual benefit to both sides. And if we cut it off, we will find that our own universities become less competitive in the global marketplace of ideas.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And one of the points that I've made is somewhat narrower, but absolutely consistent with what you're saying, is the notion of somehow that we saw during the Trump years that turning off the spigot of incoming talent to our educational institutions, the idea that that's good for America is about as dumb an idea in the context of the 21st century economy that one could imagine. Let me ask you, I know you have a book coming out on the topic of education and China's approach to education. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thank you. It'll be published by Harvard University Press, happily, early next year. And the title is Empires of Ideas, basically how great nations mobilize education and become global setters of standards in education. So in the 19th century, German universities were the leaders of the world of universities. They set global standards without question. American universities became in the game, as it were, for modern research universities by copying and emulating what the Germans were doing. But the leadership passed from Germany to America. And a question that I ask now, is it now passing to China? Because no place invests more in higher education than China today. No place takes education more seriously than China today. And here in our country, and this really worries me for our own sake, we have a consistent disinvestment, particularly in public higher education. The great public universities of the United States, University of California at Berkeley, for example, University of Michigan, and University of Washington in Seattle, have seen state levels of funding decline and decline and decline now for decades. And if we want to both cooperate and compete with our Chinese counterparts, we need to invest also in ourselves. Leadership, when one thinks the question at the end of the day is, can China lead in the world of universities as it may lead in some other areas? Leadership is a comparative measure. I don't believe that any one country in this realm can lead alone, but the United States needs to reinvest in itself and in its international relationships in order to remain on top in this industry.
On a related topic, the topic of students, in your various capacities at Harvard, you deal with students on virtually a daily basis. How do you think American millennials, young people in their 20s, view China today? What are you hearing from them as you interact with these students in the classroom and on campus? And is there, in your judgment, a qualitative difference in the perspective of young Americans toward China relative to that of Americans as a whole?
That is a great question. You know, I have a rather small sample to talk about, but I mean, it's a large number of students here at Harvard College, and I found them to be curious, above all, curious about China, interested about China. Some of them are interested, of course, in potential business careers with China, not necessarily in China, but an extraordinary level of curiosity and interest. We had today, so I teach a class, again, with my colleague, Professor Bowl. I teach a class this term. It's called China, Power and Civilization. And it's about enduring themes in Chinese history in the past and in the present. And we talk about the past and the present in every class. And the students are so well prepared. You know, Harvard students are pretty good students, but, you know, not everybody is always well prepared. These guys are curious and interested in a way that you would love to see on any topic. I think public opinion for students and others, but public opinion is very malleable in the United States. It may well be that young Americans have a more positive and more open view toward China than those who follow contemporary political rhetoric from either the Republican or Democratic leadership in Congress. But at the moment, certainly on campus here, it is a positive view. I should say it's a positive view also in a certain sense of solidarity also with the Asian American students here and the Chinese students who come to the United States, many of whom have felt since the Trump era, much less welcome. And we have a terrible history back in the McCarthyite period and in the aftermath of the Korean War of anti-Chinese sentiment in this country, of racialized profiling of Chinese. And we had an earlier history with the Exclusion Acts. We cannot go down that road again. It is so damaging to our own moral core, let alone to this relationship.
On the topic of McCarthy and McCarthyism, would it be fair in your judgment to say that we do see McCarthyist tendencies now in this country relative to China, and that there does seem to be an intense effort on the part of some to quote-unquote, root out communist agents and root out communist influence and so forth and so on. Is McCarthyism too strong a word to describe what we're seeing in this country and what we've seen over the last several years?
I would say that it's trending toward McCarthyism. Happily, we don't have somebody quite as horrific as Senator McCarthy leading the charge and turning the United States Senate into a prosecutorial unit. But you do see disproportionate investigations of Chinese scientists or Chinese American scientists on their research compared to that of any other ethnic group. And, you know, quite frankly, the FBI and other organizations have been tasked with doing this, but these are individuals who really have no capacity to judge, by and large, in my experience, the research that they are trying to investigate. And so many of these cases of alleged academic espionage have simply fallen apart, but they leave a horrible taste in the mouth, and they leave a sense that we may lose, as we did in the 1950s, a lot of talent that had come from China that feels unwelcome here. And if we do this, this is our own fault. But there is a risk and a danger of this. And it takes leadership, important leadership, to say this is not what this country is about. And I would hope that President Biden and his team would make it very, very clear that we are not profiling Chinese for their activities as Chinese in this country.
Let's turn to the business arena. As you look at U.S.-China commercial ties, that is, the linkages between the two commercial sectors, do you feel that the level of mutual understanding in that arena is increasing or remaining stagnant? Are American business professionals sufficiently knowledgeable, in your view, about Chinese business and corporate culture? And more broadly, what do Americans get right and get wrong when it comes to our understanding of the business environment in China? It's such an important issue to our nation, as we know.
In my experience, American business people who do business in China have a much keener understanding of the nature of the Chinese economy, indeed, maybe often of the nature of the Chinese political system, than do some of our policymakers back in Washington. They understand that you can't simply have a single China strategy when you enter this market. China is a multiplicity of different regional economies, each one different one from another. You have to succeed at a local level and a provincial level with critical stakeholders, as well as at times on a national level. There are thousands of American businesses, enterprises doing business in China and located in China, and they wouldn't be there unless they made money. And they do make money. The circumstances for American investment may not be perfect, but in fact, they are better today, at least in legal terms, than they were 10 years ago. What I worry about is a perception. The one thing is that American business people have also been extremely quiet, I think much too quiet, on the question of where the U.S.-China relationship is going, because they have the potential of suffering the most if economic ties fray further.
Do you think that silence, which I would agree definitely has been evident over the last several years, was mostly a function of the idea that these companies didn't want to get onto President Trump's radar and be subjected to tweets and so forth?
I think so. And, you know, a companies like to stay below the radar when they can. But I think, you know, there are important American Chamber of Commerce, certainly the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, which works with many large American corporations that do business in China. They have been starting to, as the latter very vocally, speak up about we need to ensure that the very positive aspects of Chinese-American relations in the business realm continue and they deepen. And one way they could do this is to encourage more Chinese investment in the United States. You'll remember in the spat about U.S.-Japan trade deficits in the 1980s, one way that in the Reagan administration that problem began to go away was by encouraging Japanese investment in the United States. And we see a great deal of it today. The cars that we drive that are Japanese made are mostly made in the United States. There could, and in my view, should be an effort to recruit, to invest in this country, more Chinese enterprises and more private Chinese enterprises. But thanks to the Trump administration's policies, in part, the amount of Chinese direct investment in the United States has fallen by about 90% in the last 5 years.
Yes. And frankly, I think the point that too many American policymakers and leaders fail to recognize is that that actually hurts us as much as it hurts China, if not more.
Oh, it hurts us much more.
Bill, let me ask you about an important issue in the relationship, that of technology. And as we know, there is an intense competition between the United States and China for technological supremacy. And it's one of the biggest areas of contention in the relationship today. Where do you see this competition going over the next few years? And is the current zero-sum framing posited by the United States appropriate? Or is there any scenario, in your view, in which both the United States and China can pursue their legitimate aspirations in the domain of technology without unduly challenging the legitimate interests of the other country?
You know, right now, the competition in technological matters is, of course, growing, particularly in artificial intelligence, semiconductors, 5G network rollout. Some of it is presumably legitimate national security concerns on both sides. And some of it is what I would call a kind of a mutual paranoia. So the United States reacted very powerfully to ban Huawei, the Chinese tech company, from expanding 5G networks, particularly in rural parts of the United States where no one else was investing. But the United States had not itself, no American company was capable of competing with Huawei. We had not invested in this next generation ourselves. It's either a European company or a Chinese company that is going to build this for us. That's not China's fault. That is in part our fault. I think, you know, it comes down to a very considerable degree to what level of trust can be established between two countries in this. When Microsoft went into China 2 decades ago in a very large way, Microsoft, in order to convince the Chinese government that there was not American spyware in Windows, they opened their system for the Chinese government to see, which they had done for no one else. And as a result, they got a substantial market share in China. That level of trust has not been reduplicated in the current technological scene. Huawei is accused of having a backdoor possibly for the Chinese government to get data on Americans. Quite frankly, my view is, you know, the Americans are actually very good at cyber espionage. We're pretty good. We're actually better in all likelihood than the Chinese are. If they can put a backdoor on it, we can probably put a screen door or a storm door to control it as well. Rather than ratchet up the technological warfare, one should, again, look at what are the common sets of standards and protocols that both countries can agree to. Because the alternative is a kind of a two sets of global standards, two gardens of global trade revolving around technology. And the last time the world devolved into global trading blocks – that were rooted in national systems were in the two decades before World War II. Not a healthy economic environment for the world. And this is not going to be a wise way either for the United States or for China to continue. And in the meantime, this technological warfare endangers actually one of the great companies in the world in a state that we, you know, the United States has close relationship with and a place that we have very close relations with, which is Taiwan. And no company is better in the realm of manufacturing semiconductors than Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. And yet we have pulled them in different directions, cut off their market with Huawei, and made life less certain for one of a company that is actually critical for our own economy.
I want to ask just three final questions here. And one of them is pertains to our namesake at this foundation, the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. And our namesake, President Bush, as you know, took an incredible interest in China, both before he became president and as president, and of course, in his post-presidency as well. Bill, I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts and reflections are on President George H.W. Bush's approach to China. I know you're very familiar with the way that he looked at China and saw China, and I'd be curious to get your assessment of his leadership in this particular area.
I admired President Bush's policy enormously, not just in this area, but in other areas as well. It was a policy that was very strong in the assertion of American values and interests, but it was also a foreign policy of limits, of understanding, of proportion, shall we say. And he, of course, himself was our first de facto ambassador to China, setting up the liaison office in the 1970s. He came to know China particularly well. And he believed, I think, more strongly than any president since Franklin Roosevelt, that the future of the world is a future in which China must be integrated into the world. And that the future of the United States and our foreign relations have to, in some certainly important degree, be one of cooperation and, at times, competition with China. He took what our politicians today, I think, sadly, so far, have not taken. He took the long view. He was faced, for example, with a great and difficult decision after Tiananmen, after this brutal massacre of students by Deng Xiaoping and his cohort in June of 1989, a sense, yes, of course, this was awful. But this was a regime that had actually a long history of repression of its people. This is not entirely, for those who knew the history of the Chinese Communist Party and the history of the People's Republic, this was not and should not have been entirely unexpected. And he took the long view that in time, a China integrated, not isolated from the rest of the world, would be a not necessarily a powerful and close ally of the United States, but an important partner in the building of global institutions. And if you look at a number of global institutions, including the United Nations and others, where China has played broadly a very positive role, I think he was correct. But again, he took the view that he didn't put it this way, but here's how I would put it. China has been here forever. China is going, it is a state as well as a civilization. It will evolve. No political party anywhere rules forever. We need to think of the long-term interests of the United States in dealing with a civilization that will be known as China. And we have to recognize our own youth and inexperience in this. The United States has been around as a country less long than the last Chinese dynasty, the Qing dynasty, which reigned for 268 years. So patience and vision are important at times, but patience above all, perhaps, and not to try to solve every issue at once.
Well, I think that's really well said, Bill, and I couldn't agree more that President George H.W. Bush's vision and farsightedness and ability to take the long-term perspective were really defining hallmarks of his vision as president generally, but particularly with respect to the issue of China. And I think you've really captured that very eloquently in your comments.
If I can just add one other anecdote, I was in China with a delegation from Harvard in December of the year 2000, and we met with a very senior political figure in foreign relations of the People's Republic of China on the very day when George W. Bush was confirmed, as it were, as president by the Supreme Court ruling that occurred in that month. And we met with this gentleman on that very day, and he was extremely pleased because he said to us, well, we're very pleased to see what they called Schaubuscher, little Bush, be elected, because if they have any problems with Schaubuscher, they'll call up Laubuscher, old Bush. And I actually wish they had.
That's a really interesting story, Bill. I really appreciate your sharing that with us. Bill, let me ask you, most observers, both in the United States and in China, would agree that we're presently at or very near the low water mark in U.S.-China relations subsequent to normalization in 1979. The level of mutual mistrust is at an all-time high. Each country now seems to reflexively assume the worst about the other's intentions and motives. And so I have a couple of questions around this. Number one, do you think the United States' reading of China's aspirations and intentions is broadly accurate or off the mark? And number two, do you have any thoughts as to how the two countries can get this bilateral relationship to a better and more mutually beneficial and more sustainable place?
Let me start with the second one, because we're at a moment in which signals can matter a great deal. There is a great deal of what I and others would call low-hanging fruit in the Chinese-American relationship to begin to come back to some sense of civility in it. For example, President Trump, for no good reason, ended the Fulbright program. I can't think of a dumber thing to do and more self-inflicted damage to American scholars and to educational exchange. That would be easy to reinstate. I don't know why it has not been reinstated so far. We could reopen, as you know, the consulate in Houston was closed. That, and for no good reason, in my view, that consulate could and should be reopened, and the one in Chengdu in a mutual way. We can negotiate with the Chinese side also a set of reductions of these mutually damaging tariffs that were put in place during the Trump years. All of that at mutual benefit. That's small beer, as it were, but it matters in setting the stage for perhaps a normalization of rhetoric and of expectations on both sides. The Biden administration has been excellent compared to the Trump administration in giving educational visas to young Chinese to come to the United States. And that's a very positive sign and a quietly done, but very positive side.
And with respect to this question of the U.S. reading of China's aspirations and intentions, are we getting it right, Bill?
Yeah, I think we have to look at it in both ways. I'm not sure we are getting it right because I am not sure there is a consensus in China about China's long-term aspirations and so on. It is not a question of leading the world. We're not talking here of a conquest regime. We are talking of a China that is richer, more powerful economically, more powerful militarily than ever it has been in the last century and a half. That is absolutely true. It is not necessarily one in which the fundamental interests, however, of the United States are placed in danger if there is cooperation and communication. Look at it from the Chinese. A rational person looking down, a historian looking a century from now, should look at this period and think of where do these two countries truly endanger each other? The United States, some in the United States, see an aggrandizing China, a more truculent China, and they seek to stop its rise. But at the moment, you know, it isn't clear to me. We have made difficulties over the South China Sea. We have tensions over Taiwan, some still in North Korea. But we have equally strong numbers of areas where we need to cooperate, whether it's in climate change, whether it is on nuclear proliferation, as in Korea, or on other matters. And so some sense of balance in this regard. On the Chinese side, I would say there is a real paranoia, particularly possibly in the upper echelons of the Chinese Communist Party, that the aim of the United States is regime change. You know, President Nixon went to China in 1972 and did more to bolster the Chinese Communist regime than any president, in part simply by visiting. But he believed that it was not in the foreign policy interests of the United States, and this was part of our policy toward the Soviet Union at the same time, to promote change in other areas, but to work as best we could with systems that could be quite different than our own. And there's a paranoia in China that it is the United States' goal to undermine China's growing prosperity and place in the world. That is something we should work closely against, because China itself, a rational view, China has no enemies that threatened it really today, not threaten its territory. And we are in the longest period of peace in East Asia from 1979 to the present, since the Opium War. That peace is the absolute foundation of prosperity in East Asia and of a prosperous relationship between China and the United States. Anything that endangers it from either side is potentially mutually destructive.
Bill, I'm going to go to the last question, but before I do, just one quick follow-up on a really important point that you just made about China's perception of U.S. intentions. And my question just very quickly is, do you think China's perception is unjustified, or is there justification as viewed from a Chinese perspective in their concluding what they have about U.S. intentions relative to China?
I think it's justified if you look at the rhetoric of some American leaders, particularly congressmen and senators, and some in political debates. You know, it's not easy from a great distance to like many of the actions of the Chinese Communist Party. And I certainly am a strong critic of a number of those actions. But the history of our relationship has been a history of an inability on the part of the United States to affect in a serious way domestic politics in China. You know, in the Roosevelt administration during World War II, there were some who argued that we should seek not to deal with the nationalists who are our allies and fighting the war with us, nor with the communists, but would find a third way, a third party that could take China toward a more liberal and democratic future. Well, that was not the aim of the nationalists nor of the communists who fought over control of China. And we had very little influence over its direction. Even in Taiwan, our capacity when we were allied closely with Taiwan from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to affect domestic politics in that island was extraordinarily limited. And, you know, I dare not predict what China's political future will be, but it will be a future, in my view, that looks rather different from the present, and it will be a future that will be determined by and large not by decision makers in Washington or London or Moscow or elsewhere, but in China itself.
Let me ask you this final question, and it's kind of the classic crystal ball question, and in some ways probably theoretically impossible to answer, if not in practice. But based on your understanding of the long arc of Chinese history and the U.S.-China relationship, what do you think the future holds for this relationship? Will things get worse before they get better? And what do you think the relationship is going to look like in, let's say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, I am always an optimist. So I am optimistic that in 10 or 20 years, it will look better than it does today. That really depends on something that President Bush had in spades. It depends on statesmanship and leadership and imagination. Looking again to the long haul, playing the long game. Much depends really on those who have the most at stake in the future of this relationship. And I would put that as in terms of younger people today, younger companies engaged on both sides. Let me just put it in as a metaphor. When President Nixon went to China, it was often said that the relationship between China and the United States was purely instrumental, anti-Soviet relationship. It was kind of a one-night stand. We were encouraged to think of the relationship as in Chinese as tong chuang yi meng, sleeping in the same bed while dreaming of different lovers, but very instrumentalized. Today, economically, culturally, on issues of climate change and others, the United States and China are married. And we're like an old married couple. Maybe we never got it formalized, but we have a common law marriage, an old married couple. And when one of them has a problem and rolls over, the other one certainly feels it. But more to the point is that we have children, the children who are the 370,000 Chinese who study in this country, the children who are the American companies and enterprises that have done extraordinarily well in business in China, the children that will be the results of cooperation on important matters that affect the health of our planet and affect the health of human beings across the planet. And so it is they who actually, I constantly urge them to have their voices heard about the kind of relationship that they would seek to have between these two countries, and not simply, to the degree that they can make those voices heard, leave things to political decision makers.
Well, Dr. Kirby, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I want to thank you so much for your time today, and especially for your really deep and thoughtful insights. Thank you so much for all that you've shared.
Thank you very much, David.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you for listening.